Now, I'd like to ask you how the present border between the United States and Mexico was finally determined, the border that was, as I understand it, defined and agreed to by the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo.
Well, the negotiations concerning the treaty evidently discussed a number of possibilities as to where the border could be drawn, and we might all still be speaking Spanish if some of those negotiations had gone through, because there were a number of proposals to draw the line much higher. And eventually, the decision was made to draw the line at one marine league south of the end of San Diego Bay. This would, from the standpoint of the Americans, give them the marvelous harbor of San Diego, and from the standpoint of the Mexicans who were negotiating the treaty, it by not going further south, it gave them a land bridge between Baja California and the mainland of Mexico.
Often, borders between nations follow the topography of the land that itself naturally separates peoples, but there is no such natural boundary between San Diego and Tijuana. The special situation of this border is the basis for a San Diego organization known as Fronteras de las Californias, or the Border of the Californias. The aim of the Fronteras program is to provide effective liaison and communication across the border for the two communities of San Diego and Tijuana. The executive vice president of Fronteras is Dr. Lucy Killay.
The geographic region which encompasses San Diego and Tijuana, and which had a unity in the Spanish and Mexican period, and certainly has a geographic unity, had this artificial line put into it. And this is really one of the most interesting things today, as we're now looking at our region. We, with this tremendous population we have, we now realize that boundary line doesn't separate us, really. We have the same air pollution problems, the same water sewage disposal problems we must share. And one of the people who was foremost in visualizing this and who started this Fronteras program, really, was Hamilton Marston, although he is too modest to admit it in those terms. He had a very good grasp of the situation. He pointed out how San Diego Harbor had the potential under Spain and Mexico to be the gateway for all of the hinterland, all the way back to the river, the Colorado River, the whole southern part of California and into Arizona, the whole southwest and the northwest part of Mexico. With the artificial line put there, suddenly San Diego, with its beautiful harbor, became a dead end rather than a gateway. And something the same happened to the Baja California side. In other words, rather than having access to a harbor which had the potential for tremendous development, they also became the end of the line for their own in Mexico. So you had really two very sleepy communities as a result that were largely ignored by their own countries and had much in common. The two cities are very close together now, and the tremendous amount of interchange across the border, despite some slowdown on holidays and so on, is one of the most crossed borders in the world. Metropolitan areas in any one country have enough problems, but when you have a large metropolitan area, and we will be 3 million people in this area by 1990, certainly by the turn of the century, and you have that many people in a relatively small area, it is artificial because the human action, interaction, is taking place constantly in all kinds of ways, economically, socially, politically. Even the tourism is a rather superficial kind of interchange, but is a very real one.
Could you tell us a little bit about the Fronteras program? As I understand, it was set up as a sort of bicentennial program in 1976, but it has continued on. And what kinds of things does Fronteras do?
Fronteras is a liaison organization. We are attempting to make the communications across the border, either open up the communication when it's not there in areas in which people have, or institutions, whether it's government or private, have common interests, have mutual goals, but they cannot transcend that barrier of language or political or legal or linguistic barrier. We try to help get people together.
Dr. Lucy Killay, Executive Vice President of Fronteras de las Californias. The Mexican era came to a close with the American acquisition of the Southwest. After the Mexican War, the citizens of what had once been part of Mexico were fairly soon overwhelmed by the flood of new American settlers. And we also see a significant cultural change in San Diego. What were some of the elements of that change in culture, Claire?
I think one way of looking at the cultural change is that the economy became very different from being essentially one based on ranching. The economy of San Diego developed in a greater variety of ways after the American conquest.
Charles Hughes of the San Diego Historical Society has done a great amount of research on the subject of the cultural change that occurred after California became a part of the United States.
I found that San Diego wasn't like the rest of Southern California. That, number one, the Californios in San Diego did not have the large herds of cattle then that the Californios in Los Angeles and Santa Barbara had. So they hadn't the herds to drive north to make the large profits and things. And the Californios also were very quickly outnumbered by the Anglos in San Diego. And so they lost political control, and taxes were imposed, and they couldn't meet their tax obligations. The climate was very dry. They couldn't grow the crops then to sell to the markets and things and to make profit in that regard. So they lost their lands then. Politically, they lost control by the 1850 election. Estudillo, Antonio Estudillo and Juan Bandini each win election to office in 1850, but after that there's only three or four Californios out of better 100 elective offices that are elected in the first 6 years then. Only three or four Californios are elected to office. Anglos outnumbered the Californios by 3-1 then. And I'm thinking then of the male population. There was over 300 Anglos or Americans then, and then there were 96, I believe, if I'm recalling correctly, California men then, over 21 years of age and eligible to vote. Socially, they remained a predominant group. The male population, or the Anglo population, was predominantly male then. So they kept the cultural ties and the social ties. And you hear of the dances and the social gatherings, and there's the social intercourse, and they get along, and they exist together then down here. But economically then the Californios begin to decline immediately, and by the 60s and 70s then the lands are passing from their hands.
What we have seen is first a gradual influx of Anglo-Americans until just after the Mexican War, when the cry for gold brought inundations of fortune seekers to the West.
When formed our band, we are well manned to journey afar to the promised land. The golden ore is rich in store on the banks of the Sacramento shore. Then ho, boys, ho, for California-o. There's plenty of gold, so I've been told, on the banks of the Sacramento.
The Mexican War brought San Diego under the United States flag, but it was the gold rush that brought a new culture in large enough numbers to profoundly affect the lives of the Californios. The family of Roberto Estudillo did return to Mexico. But, as he says, many others remained in San Diego.
The old people there from San Diego, the old Mexican or Spanish families, that or Californias that they used to call themselves, they intermarried with the Americans that were coming into San Diego, like a lot of the officers of Navy officers and Army officers were intermarrying to our family, like Johnsons and Couts and Davis, and they were intermarried with the old families in California. A lot of them stayed in California. Others immigrated back into Mexico, like my grandfather. He immigrated back into Mexico, and he immigrated here into Tijuana.
Why did he? Did he have any reasons he told you about?
That's a mystery. I haven't been able to find out why. Probably he got discouraged with the American way of living. They used to live like dons, and they were not satisfied the way they were treated by the Americans after a few years of living in California. Mm-hmm. So they immigrated back into Mexico. They didn't have any contact with the way of how the Americans were living, so they wanted to go back and live the way they were living in the old days.
Roberto Estudillo, the great-grandson of Don José Antonio Estudillo. We've discussed the clash of two cultures at great length. But what about the Indians? We examined in our last program the effects of secularization of the missions on the native San Diegans. But what has happened in the meantime between 1833 and the Mexican War?
Well, for the Indians who had been attached to the missions, and even those who had not, who were living farther out in the backcountry, the secularization was a great disruption of their life. The concept had been that the land would be turned over to the Indians, but in fact this did not happen. There were only a few Indians who received any land grants at all, and those who did lost their lands either because they entered into mortgages or some other kind of agreements which they didn't understand, or in some instances the Rancho Guajome, for example, the two Indians to whom that was granted apparently sold it. At any rate, the Indians after secularization, their whole basic pattern of life seemed to be very much disrupted, and this leads to increasing hostilities. There were many Indian raids on, particularly, of course, on outlying ranches in the late 1830s, and even a number of plots, which were unsuccessful, to raid San Diego itself, to take over the entire town. One of them, which involved some Indian servants in the Pueblo of San Diego, was not accomplished. Some of the Indian servants whose loyalty was to the family for whom they worked rather than to the other Indians told about the plot, and Sergeant Gonzalez, when he captured the men that he considered responsible for the plot, summarily had them executed. And Estudillo, who was at that time the judge, complained that they should have had a hearing, they should have had some kind of trial, but this was not done. By 1851, there were enough reasons for Indian disturbance so that Antonio Gara was able to really get a large number of Indians from several different tribes together and put on what amounted to a large-scale organized revolt.
And again, we hear from Charles Hughes.
Antonio Gara was a leader of the Indians in northern San Diego area. Joshua Bean, then the sheriff at that time and mayor, went up and told the Indians that they had to pay this tax, and the Indians resisted. They didn't like it. It was something they were unfamiliar with. They felt it was unjust. They felt it was an attempt then to take their cattle away from them. They were told that they couldn't pay the taxes, that their cattle would be taken to pay for the tax, and so they organized this revolt. They hoped then to enlist the Californios to rise up and expel the Anglos completely and the Americans then, and to reestablish their own form of government then. Californians evidently did not cooperate or did not get involved or support them at all. There was the outbreak of the attack on the Warner's Hot Springs then, and three or four people were killed, and then the subsequent militia came in, and Gara was arrested and eventually hung then in San Diego.
Charles Hughes, archivist with the San Diego Historical Society. And for more background on Gara and the events that led up to his execution, we turn to Roy Cook, who teaches American Indian Studies at San Diego State University and Grossmont College.
Antonio Gara was a Copeño Indian who had some sore points with the folks in that area and started to organize and spread the word and to build an effort at direct action. As such, as so many other efforts of indirect action, he was labeled a criminal and a robber and was designated to be not a very good person. And in fact, the Indian police were enlisted to bring him to justice. It has been said that Antonio Gara, which is the leader or the patriot, depending on one's perspective, of the uprising, was in league with a number of also agitated Californios, or non-Indian people who lived in Southern California at the time. Estudillo has been mentioned as being one of the persons. Later on, even though he had been accused of being a part of the conspiracy, he was cleared of that by a peer group. Antonio Gara, it's interesting to note, when he was captured, was brought into town and held under military arrest, and he was never tried. He was summarily executed.
We've heard about the conflicting claims for land of the Californios and Indians during the Mexican period, and of course between all the previous inhabitants of this region and the American newcomers.
The actual sovereignty of the predecessors, the Spanish and the Mexican people, only extended on a very, very narrow strip of the coastline. The majority of the state of California was entirely under Indian dominion. Now, they didn't tax people, publish notices, exact tolls and fees for people going through the land, because that wasn't the game was played amongst the native people. But nevertheless, the fact remains that I have claimed the entire city of El Cajon a number of times. I've declared it to be my entire possession. I'm going to start taxing the people by the same sovereignty that the state of California fell onto the federal government. Just by saying so, or by fiat, doesn't make it so. I don't care who it is who says it's so. And that's really where the nature of the sovereignty issue and the land question, it is still very, very involved. In that the rights of native peoples were clearly defined by the Mexican government. Whether they were acknowledged by example and precedent in each and every instance is another question. But there were enough instances of acknowledgement of native rights, of native people, Indian people, if you will, rights, to recognize that there was a system of governmental acknowledgement of Indian rights by the Mexican people. When the United States accepted the conditions or dictated the conditions of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, amongst were that some of the many conditions were that all of the people now residing would have not only the privilege but the opportunity, etc., of becoming citizens of the United States with no risk or loss of their own land. The colonizing forces and governmental spheres of influence that were brought to bear upon native people had already been established. Whereas with the Spanish and with the Mexican people, there was not only a means of absorption of native people into the area, they could not exist without native people. What we see coming to bear with this entire sphere of influence, not only social but also political, with the native people and the Anglo people, is that the Anglo people didn't need the Indians. The Spanish people needed the Indian people. The Mexican people needed the Indian people. They couldn't have done anything without them. So what we have going here is the people had been moving little by little due to the encroachments, the size of the ranchos, the oppressiveness of the labor conditions. They'd moved and tried to maintain their own lifestyles. Now, with the Anglo invasion, there's no place at all for them. So the efforts are to remove them from the immediate area, remove them from the outlying areas, and if at all possible, to remove them from the conscience of America.
Roy Cook, with the Departments of American Indian Studies at San Diego State University and Grossmont College. We've seen many changes that were brought to San Diego during a very brief period. Don José Antonio Estudillo died in 1852, before he could have seen the full impact of the California Gold Rush. And those changes are described here by another descendant of the Estudillo family, Victor McGee, a fifth-generation San Diegan who teaches San Diego history at the Mason Street Schoolhouse in Old Town State Park.
When they came, San Diego grew. San Diego grew not because the gold rush was here, but it was in San Francisco and as the port that they came into, and then up into the gold fields from there. But here was a port, and people were stopping here on the way up from the Panama area, also stopping here as they were coming by land trails over the mountains and into San Diego. And so they were growing. And you might have said that they was a little bit said about drinking before that time, but very, very small amount. But now, at the period of time when all the Spaniards or the Californians had left San Diego and went up to the gold field, you might have find five groggeries. When the miners came back to San Diego, you had as many as every Californian's home had a groggery and sold liquor. This is part of it, as we sort of picture in the Wild West. It's a picture, too, of crime, more now than they had before. It's a picture of the Spaniards, or the Californians, I prefer to call them, not understanding English well enough. And these social changes took place because of it, and the pressures of the numbers of people coming. Then, as the gold rush simmered down, they simply went back to their more normal ways.
Victor McGee, who teaches San Diego history at the Mason Street Schoolhouse in Old Town. And so we see the end of an era in San Diego, an era symbolized in many ways by people like Don José Antonio Estudillo. And as our program ends, what would you say, Claire, in conclusion about Estudillo's importance to San Diego and also about the importance of the era that he represents?
Don José Antonio Estudillo was one of the most important representatives of the Mexican era in San Diego's history. That relatively short period of time between the Mexican Revolution of 1821 and the American conquest in 1846, when California became part of the United States. Estudillo serves as a great link between the Spanish, the Mexican, and the American periods of San Diego's history. He and his family symbolize both continuity and change in our historical development. His father, José María Estudillo, was born in Spain, came to Mexico as a Spanish soldier. He served in the Presidio in Monterrey and was commandant of the San Diego Presidio from 1827 until his death in 1830. The son, Don José Antonio Estudillo, also served in the Army, but is much better known for his role in developing the civilian government in San Diego, for his involvement in cattle ranching and agriculture. One of the most significant things he did, it seems to me, looking back from our present perspective, was to urge the establishment of pueblo status, that is, town government, for San Diego in the 1830s. 100 years later, the city of San Diego was able to acquire municipal control of its water system because of a legal decision based on the fact that San Diego had been a pueblo, a legally recognized town, in 1835. Don José served as alcalde, which is similar to mayor, judge, and treasurer in Mexican San Diego, and then he held office as county treasurer, or county assessor, rather, after California became part of the United States in the 1850s. He also advocated the development of Newtown, the subdivision on the shores of the harbor where the present Embarcadero is located. And although he did not invest in the subdivision himself, members of his family did. His son-in-law, Miguel de Pedro Reno, was one of the partners in the new town development. And, of course, the leading investor in that was William Heath Davis, an American merchant who was married to Don Jose's niece, Maria Estudillo. Another important way in which the Estudillo family forms a link between the past and the present is that Don Jose's son, Jose Guadalupe Estudillo, was San Diego County Treasurer in the 1860s and 70s, and he was president of the city's Board of Trustees in 1868, when 1,400 acres were set aside for our great Balboa Park. The Casa de Estudillo, an Old Town State Park, is a kind of three-dimensional historic document that helps to remind us of the Hispanic heritage of San Diego. Having this whole group of buildings and these activities in Old Town reminds us all that our present life is much richer and more interesting because the fabric of our community is a mosaic of many cultures.
Dr. Claire Crane, San Diego historian and chief consultant for this series of programs on San Diego history. With Don José Antonio Estudillo died an era, and the face of San Diego was to change drastically as the cry of gold echoed throughout the West and created a deluge of new immigrants to San Diego. They had visions of wealth and the hope of a new life here. The new immigrant was in many ways exemplified by Lewis Rose, land developer, businessman, and the first Jewish resident of San Diego. His life is the subject of next week's program. 12 Who Shaped San Diego is a series of radio programs on local history, biographies of 12 great men and women who have left their mark on today's San Diego. The programs are heard each week at 12:30 Tuesday afternoon with a repeat broadcast Wednesday night at 8 o'clock. A resource packet is available with these programs. Send $2 to KPBS FM, San Diego 92182, and ask for the San Diego History Resource Packet. We also welcome your comments on this series. The address, again, is KPBS-FM, San Diego, 92182. I'm Peter Hamlin, series producer, thanking you for joining us. 12 Who Shaped San Diego is a production of public radio station KPBS-FM and is made possible by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities.